VorpalNetwork.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, it's Jeff Greiner from The Tome Show here, and I'm bringing you a special episode straight from D&D Experience 2011. It's the second biggest D&D convention of the year. This is an unedited Wizards of the Coast session from the con. I've had some people being really fantastic about going to those sessions and recording them and sending them on to me, and so I get to share them with you. Just a quick look. Couple of quick reminders while you're listening to this. If you're listening within the first few months of 2000, or the first half, I'd say, of 2011, we have a contest going on. Go to thetomeshow.com and find a link to the contest page for all the details, where you can win prizes from Aaliyah Tools, Noble Knight Games, Sonic Legends, Obsidian Portal, Q Workshop, Gnome Stew, Sly Flourish, Epic Words, and more yet to be announced. So check those out. Also, I wanted to remind you that this episode, like all the latest Tome Show episodes, are brought to you by Noble Knight Games. Check them out, and if you happen to buy some stuff, make sure you tell them that the Vorpal Network sent you.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
On a lot of different things. Both Greg and I, Greg Bilson and I. And so we can answer pretty much any freelancing questions you have about how you get published working for Wizards of the Coast. These two guys, Steve and
my
Rob,
esteemed companion,
have gone through the process in a lot of respects. They started off as freelancers pitching articles and whatnot and are now writing books for us.
There this is true.
There he is.
We got held up.
Yeah. At gunpoint. We saw.
They were.
It
was tragic.
We were out there laughing at you. You just didn't see us.
That's okay. Your chair, Mike.
Anyways. Just to complete the introductions, I'm Chris Perkins. This is Mike Merles. He is the group manager for D&D.
How are you, sweetie?
He is in charge of setting our strategic direction. Here's Rob Schwab.
Hi.
Freelancer extraordinaire. Steve Townsend, freelancer extraordinaire. They have a great deal of experience working with us, and I'm sure they will speak honestly and openly about their Wizards experiences.
You bet.
Sure.
You
bet. Yeah. All right. So, before we kick things up, is there any questions or things that people wanted to ask right out the gate, either about adventure design or about the... how we do things at Wizards. All right. Then let's begin by having these guys talk a little bit about their freelance experiences and what they think of adventure design.
Go ahead. Oh, boy. Freelance experiences. I got started just kind of... submitting contest entries to Polyhedron in the 90s, and
everybody know Polyhedron is here, right?
It was the RPGA magazine.
Some of you probably weren't born in the 90s.
Yeah. I won one contest where if you won, then you got a copy of Polyhedron number 1 that I'm still waiting for. I called the mail order hobby shop like 3 times to be like, because that was the only number for TSR that I had, and I was like, excuse me, I'm waiting for my Polyhedron number 1 that I won a contest for 2 years ago. The guy's like, yeah, we'll send it. I eventually ended up submitting some article or some proposals for Dragon, which were rejected and terrible. And over the years, I I gave up, and then a few years later, I tried again. And then I eventually hit with one, and over time, I hit with a couple more, and I think that there was a job opening at Wizards in 2007, and I had I had applied for it, and by the time I applied for it, I had a few credits. That I think that's what one of the things that got my my resume in a little bit more. And then I tried really hard on the design test, and eventually got through to an interview with Bill Slavicek and Andy Collins. And my friend Peter Lee got that job. And the next year, there was another job at Wizards that was open that I don't think was ever filled. That I also, you know, got in, passed the design test, had a phone interview, and that ended up netting me some work on Monster Manual 3 with Mike, and then the rest is I've worked consistently since then. So I'll just, because I've already spoken for a while, I'll just cover the how I got into freelancing for Wizards a bit and talk about adventure design later.
Okay. Well, my story is fairly similar, actually. I started working for D20. It was pretty much brand new, and I had jumped on board with an open call for a third-party publisher, and I was Mongoose Publishing, in fact. And Mongoose had—I was just out of college, and I was very excited. Didn't think I could do it, but I was gonna give it a try. Mongoose decided they wanted to—they liked the proposal. They bought it. It led to another job. I did freelancing, making hundreds of dollars a year for that first year. And then I got a job as a line developer for D20 for Green Ronin Publishing. And then shortly after that, I was leading Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. And all through this time, I always felt that Wizards of the Coast was the unattainable job. There was no way I would ever be able to work for Wizards. And I had talked to Eric Munn at the time, who was editor-in-chief of Dragon Magazine, and I courted him and bought him dinner and did everything I could to try to get it, to get one article. But no, it was always too far. And so I guess it was a couple of years into this, and I was hanging out with Rodney Thompson. I said, "Boy, you know, I'd like to do something for D&D, because, you know, I'm a big D&D fan, and I still do Warhammer and stuff, but I really like D&D a lot. If, you know, maybe you could introduce me to Chris Perkins, maybe that'd be great." So end of the show, I'm at the Green Ronin booth. Rodney comes up with Chris Perkins, and we shook hands. I said, "Look, you know, if there's anything you need me to help out on, just let me know." I was like, "Oh wow, I blew that completely." But shortly afterwards, I got an email to work on Tome of Magic for 3.5, and it's been magic and romance ever since. But, you know, the thing is, the big takeaway from this is that Wizards seems to be like the ultimate prize. And, you know, the thing is that, and this is an old boss at McDonald's told me this once. He said, you know, everybody puts their pants on the same way. And even though that sometimes Wizards can seem almost, you know, the unattainable job, to write the article for Dragon or whatever, you can do it if you're persistent and you're dedicated and you really believe in what you do. And so, thanks, Kitten.
You're welcome, Honey Bunch.
All right. My experience in sort of getting into the industry is very closely tied to adventure design. If somebody were to hold a, you know, knife to my throat and say, "What do you like to do most in life?" I think adventure design might be number one on that list. It feels like something I was born to do, and it's something that I do as eagerly as anything else. And I began writing adventures when I was 16. I mean, real. I don't mean like the type of adventures I just run for my next door neighbor to try to kill off all of his characters, which I did, and which were ghastly and horrible and bad. But actual things that I thought other people would enjoy. These first initial forays to send submissions to what was then a very young Dungeon magazine were met with disappointment, as my ideas did not exactly mesh with the desires of the editors. But I was persistent, and after a year's worth of proposals, they relented, if not through sheer frustration, then maybe they saw something in there that they could actually use, and gave me my first shot, and they accepted it, the actual article, because I'd put a lot of effort into making sure I delivered on what I promised, and that it was written in the best possible way I could. And it held to the tenets of what I understood adventure design to be, which I had absorbed through adventures that TSR had produced up to that point. And I literally owned every single one of them. If you ask me any trivia about any old adventure that TSR produced, chances are I will know what you're talking about and will be able to tell you about it in great and nauseating detail. So, with that experience behind me, over a period of several years, I started to pitch more ideas. and more were rejected than not, but through tenacity, I kept sending ideas, they kept asking me for adventures, they published them. We got to a point where they started to ask me for material. We have an idea that we want to do here. We have a new campaign setting here. We need somebody to write the adventure to support it. Would you do that? And I said, yes! Thank you! I'll do whatever you ask, and I'll do it on time, and I'll give you exactly what you asked for. And that's what I did time and again. Then TSR exploded. And little bits of shrapnel flew all over Wisconsin, and Wizards of the Coast swooped in, took the company and many of its employees westward to continue the great D&D legacy. Not everyone who worked at TSR wanted to go, and one of the people who opted not to was the then editor of Dungeon Magazine. And as I had written a number of articles for Dungeon up to that point, and as I had gotten to know the staff quite well, I seemed like a natural choice in their minds to fill that position, and so they offered it to me. And I abandoned my family and my job and everything else and went out west and joined Wizards of the Coast and worked on Dungeon Magazine for over 4 years, which was the best job in the universe and still is the best job in the universe, although I'm very happy with what I'm doing now in R&D. There's one little footnote I'd like to add to that, and that is one of the things I did to ingratiate myself to TSR back in the day was while I was teaching, I would take my summers off, drive down from Toronto, Ontario, to Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, stick my foot in their door and say, would you like me to help you clear out your magazine submission stack? And since their stack was taller than any of their employees, they said yes. And so I would basically do the what was to some extent considered heavy lifting and sifting through all of their stacks of submission envelopes, opening them up, looking at the submissions, and sort of separating them between what I thought was good, what I thought the editors needed to see. And they considered that such a valuable experience that I don't think they ever forgot who I was. And I sort of burned myself into their subconscious when they were looking for people to fill positions. I still love writing adventures, and I do it all the time, even though most of what I write these days will never, ever see print. I write adventures for my own games constantly. I've done fourth edition translations for old TSR adventures that are just waiting for whatever. I don't care. I didn't write them for any reason other than to enjoy the process of writing them and the hope and aspiration of someday finding a use for them.
So I'm Mike Merles. I started freelancing in the late 90s for a couple different role-playing games, one called Unknown Armies, one called Feng Shui. Unknown Armies was a modern cult conspiracy game. Feng Shui was an action movie RPG. And then that was around 98, 99. I also did some work on the World of Darkness games. And then when third edition got announced, I kind of knew. I was at Gen Con with the announcement. I was in the audience. And I figured I had to get my finger in this pie somehow. That was like my goal. And then when they announced the D20 license, I thought, this is great. This is exactly what I've been waiting for. It's a chance to start publishing stuff. And at about the same time, Wizards announced the launching of the Living Greyhawk campaign. There were Eric Mona putting out some notice on the internet somewhere or at a convention that they're looking for people to be triads to help run this campaign. So I applied for that, became a triad, and I got accepted and was sent an early playtest copy of 3rd edition. So I, being kind of a scheming sort of person here, I have these rules, and I'm under NDA, and there are all these companies that want to do D20 stuff. I can't actually show them anything that I have, but I could write an adventure right now and sell it the day that the NDA is lifted. So I ended up doing that with a company called Atlas Games, who had published Unknown Armies and Feng Shui, so they knew who I was. So I basically told them, hey, there's a game coming out in August of 2000. It's the newest edition of a fantasy game you may have heard of. I have rules to those, which you can't see, but I'm writing an adventure for my own use, but maybe you'd want to publish it at some point. So that's how I got my first start, was with an adventure. It was called In the Belly of the Beast. It was basically a kind of locked room kind of mysteries thing where the characters are trapped in the sewers with a bunch of NPCs who all want to kill each other, and you only have so much time to get out before this huge creature awakens and kills everybody. So that was my first start with adventures, and for about the first year or so, I wrote nothing but adventures for D20 companies. Necromancer games, Fantasy Flight, I even submitted something to a dungeon that got rejected.
Sorry.
And basically from there, I just kept freelancing, started doing more source books for different D20 companies. And the thing I think you kind of notice so far, like I think all three of these guys have mentioned this, at some point companies started coming to me and saying, hey, we need this written. And I think that was pretty much driven by, I would hit my deadlines, which doesn't seem to be that big of a deal, but if you hit your deadlines, you're ahead of 90% of the people who try to write stuff. And I would write what I was asked to write, which again, if you do that, you're ahead of 90% of the people who try to freelance. That paying attention, listening, like this is what we want you to write, and say, okay, that's what I should write. Obviously, you want to have your take on it, but you want to fulfill what you've been asked to do, and turning it in on time are the two number one, the two most important skills you could have as a freelancer. That it isn't really about being the super creative person, you know, or being super insightful or having florid, beautiful prose. 99% of it is just the workmanlike, day-to-day, getting the writing done, making sure it's clear, making sure it's on target as far as topic and what this person's looking for, and turning it on time.
Or early.
Yeah, or early. And then being open to making changes, because inevitably, no matter how good you are, at some point someone will say, hey, we asked you to write this, and maybe things have changed, or we're not crazy about this one aspect of it, we'd like to make some changes. And doing those three things will put you into the position where eventually you can start doing what you want to do, because once companies start to trust you, they'll start saying, hey, just, we want an adventure, write one. You know, do whatever you want. No company, with any sense, is going to go to someone who has never written for them before and say, here's $5,000 or $3,000, whatever, how many dollars, write an adventure for us, and turn it in whenever you want, and make it be about whatever you want. Have fun, right? And that's charity, that's not work. And that's basically, I mean, I think these guys, that's basically how I worked my way up through the ranks, was doing that. Till eventually I got a job working at Bell Havoc Press, Monty Cook's company. I worked for Paizo, like, for 3-4 months doing the Dragon Magazine Compendium. And then I got a job at Wizards. And that's, I think those three skills were basically, they are basically just typical people skills. They're not, you don't need to go to school to learn how to, when someone says, hey, can you make some changes, say yes, not, you know, bleep, 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 go to hell. That's, which I have seen happen with some writers who just don't want their stuff to get tinkered with at all.
Yeah. So I think that everybody's mentioned is persistence is like the biggest thing. I think that like if I were to sum it up in three key points, I'd say persistence, practice, and luck. And the first two will make you ready for when the third one happens. And as you'll hear about from all these guys all were persistent in their younger years, I would say, and were successful pretty fast. Whereas, you know, I flirted around a little bit when I was in my early 20s and got some polyhedron stuff, and then in my mid 20s, you know, wrote a Dragon article, and then not until I was 34 did I start writing, you know, the more serious stuff and things that I'm writing now. But in that time, when in my 20s, I was an actor, and that was my only passion. It had been my only passion through life. And what I learned from that, from working for a lot of really good theaters, was that you would only get hired and asked back if you did the best job that you possibly could and consistently managed to make as many people happy as possible. And really, I took... I had a heart-rending experience for a theater called American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin, and it's the best theater that I've ever seen or done. And everyone there works so hard that, and when I say it's heart-rending, it's just because I was there as a really small roles, and I knew that unless I went through graduate school, I wouldn't really be going back there. So when I took the experience that I saw all of those actors pouring into that, and when I was asked by Wizards to do something, I tried to take that work ethic that I had learned and pour it into the Wizards work. And I think that practice that you do is what makes you ready for when you have the opportunity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, it showed through. I mean, Steve worked on Monster Manual 3. I was the lead designer on it. And I remember what was the entry? The nature spirits.
The nymphs.
Yeah, the nymphs. I had him do the nymph entry, and for his art order, you went out and took photographs of, what was it, like a Renaissance
fair? Oh, yeah, the Bristol Renaissance Fair. There were a lot of fantasticals, fairies there.
So he took photos. He went out for his art order. Like most people in art order will just sit and write a paragraph describing something. He went out to a Ren Fair with his camera, snapped photos, and used that and sent that to me as part of the art order. Like, that to me is like, it's so easy for someone to just to write a few sentences and going the extra mile, we noticed that. You know, having that tenacity and that drive, and that's part of what said, hey, let's give this guy more work, because the work ethic is everything. If you have that, everything else will follow. Because you can learn to design. You can learn to write well. You can learn to write clearly. I mean, I don't know if you've ever learned to write like Shakespeare, but you can easily learn to write like any newspaper writer or most novelist.
And frankly, we don't want writers who write like Shakespeare.
Yeah. No more than Jadaos. But it's just a lot of game writing is just clarity. It's just learning to say, you know, if you have to write a rule, write the rule in a way that people understand it. They're not confused by it. If you're writing an adventure, you're going to describe an NPC's motivations, that it's writing that makes it plain. This is what this guy is like. And so you can read it, understand it, and then play that role as the DM. You know, you don't necessarily need to write florid prose or you know, really, you know, it's just a lot of the workmanlike characteristics that go behind it.
Right.
I think anyone up here would say ideas are cheap, that it isn't the idea, it's the execution behind it. That's the difference between something worth reading and something that gets passed over.
Indeed. In good sooth, sir.
At this point in time, any questions or comments, either about the writing process as you've sort of personally discovered it, or about adventure design and what you think of it? Is it easy? Is it hard?
Could I have a question real quick?
Sure.
You mentioned that you continue to write adventures now.
Yes.
For your own pleasure, whether they're going to get published or not.
Mm.
Do you follow, is there a format that you're following that is similar to what you would see on a published adventure, or do you deviate greatly because you don't need it to be in a certain format?
That's a fine question. If for the adventures that I create for my campaign, they're sort of in a shorthand, because I know that I'm creating my campaign for my players, not for a greater audience, and so I don't need to write them out in any length, and frankly, I just don't have the time. I've got two different groups each week going through the campaign. There's just not enough hours in the day. I would not be able to perform my job. So that's a lot of notes. Okay, stat blocks for important NPCs and such like that, but maps that I create, that's pretty much all I get out of those adventures. Nothing that's publishable, really. Except maybe the maps, because my maps are pretty... Even my raw maps are...
Scary?
Scary good. it's the drafting background and stuff like that. But I also write adventures and do things that I don't necessarily tie to my campaign. I just do it for the writing exercise, and I try to follow format. Like I've done a 4th edition adaptation of Against the Giants, and I wrote that as a 4th edition adventure using all the 4E formats with page layout and everything. There was no agenda there. I was comfortable writing that adventure in that format, and I figured at some point in the future, maybe it'll get used somewhere. I don't know that for a fact, but if it does, I'd like to do as little work to it at that point as possible. So it's a bit aspirational.
I did the same thing with Sunken Citadel and Forge of Fury.
Mm.
They're both ready to go.
Yeah.
You converted them to the 4th edition?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I did the same thing. In fact, I actually set aside an hour every day to work on other projects that I'm not getting paid for, to build a stable of extra design that I can always pull from. I'm not as obsessed with adventures as you are,
yeah,
but
I'm pretty obsessed.
I do a lot of adventure design at home, because I think that's the most challenging aspect of freelance game design.
You share that opinion with at least one other person in R&D. Why do you say that?
Because if you're designing a class, you have a vague idea about how much space a class is going to take up. But the class, you can visualize what a class is going to do. You can play around. For example, if I'm going to create a power, I can see the action happening in my head, and then build the mechanics to kind of replicate that action. With an adventure, it's a little trickier, because we know that if I'm going to do a one-page encounter, it is 675 words long if it's going into a print product, or it's going to be 800 minus 200 and something words. for the magazine, and so I don't think about creating the adventure in the same way. I think about the adventure. I have to say, well, I know I have page. I have a page constraint that says, well, if I have two stat blocks in this, that means there need to be fewer features because I only have one page to play with. If it's two pages, well, then I need to have a little bit more complicated background to play with, or I need to add three more stat blocks. And so it becomes a whole different kind of world of design. I can do it, and of course I have done it, but...
So it's the fourth edition format that's the technical constraints of the actual...
Right, right. I think that, you know, and as I've done several adventures for fourth edition, yeah. It's I've gotten to the point where I'm more comfortable with it. And it's been long enough since I've written an adventure for another system that I'm not quite sure what that'd be like anymore, but... Yeah, it's a technical side.
I'm like totally polar opposite of these guys in terms of adventure design. I say what do I want the mood or feel or end kind of feeling to be like? Not necessarily even the event or conclusion, because I don't want to railroad anything too far. And then I think, what is the opposite of that? What's the farthest from that I can go? And that's the beginning. And then I work really hard to find where a good point would be for that arc to transition. But I come from a dramatic background, so that's the way that I think about things. Once I have that arc, and I know, you know, then I look at, you know, the characters. If I'm doing what I'm doing right now, which is working on a organized play, pre-gen, I'll go through the characters and figure out what the characters are all about and what I want their stories to be like. Once I have that stuff, then I go and I look at the mechanics and think about what kind of interesting things I want to do that serves that story. But that's because that's my background.
With me, it's adventure design is an exploration, both in terms of format and in terms of content. A lot of the adventures I point to that are the favorites that I've worked on, and the favorites that are just out there in the world are very different from one another. They each do something particularly well, but that something isn't necessarily the same thing. You can take a look at some classic adventures like The Sinister Secret of Saltmarsh, and you can compare it to Tomb of Horrors, and they are not at all alike, either in terms of the way the adventure flows or the way they're physically structured. Tomb of Horrors sort of epitomizes a certain type of adventure. Saltmarsh sort of epitomized a certain type of adventure. They became, in their own way, sort of hallmarks of, if you want an adventure of this type, look here. It's the best of that type. And there have been adventures like that across all of the editions of the game. What's your favorite adventure?
Or
adventures?
That's a good question. As far as stuff that I've played, so
that's a good qualifier.
Yeah, I mean, as far as stuff I've played around. So first of all, I'm probably the worst adventure writer sitting up here. I'm not that great at writing adventures.
But you know a good one when you see it.
I hope I do. That's part of my job. But probably but the best one. I don't know why this is asking me such a hard question for me. I had a lot of fun with a lot of the dungeon adventures in the early 90s for 2nd edition. Mm-hmm. And there was an adventure called The Siege of Kratos Freehold that I had a ton of fun with because it was so open-ended. So basically, the adventure was just you're traveling across the plains, you come to this freehold, you go, that's a little manor house, a little fortified wall, you spend the night there, and the next morning you wake up and there's an orc army that's invading the land, and you have to defend this freehold. And I got really into it, so I read the entire adventure. This is back when I played a lot of Warhammer. So I had miniatures for all the orcs and all the guards, and I built the old, I don't know if some of you remember the old TSR, the paper fold-out, mm-hmm. cut-out and fold and glue
buildings.
I mm-hmm. built the entire manor, and so when I ran it, I had everything in 3D, and I had all the troops lined up, and I had everything set up, and we played like that. It took 12 hours to play through that entire adventure, and we just had a blast with it. And I guess maybe just a sucker from the oats made me think there's also the Alderaan series, the Gauntlet and the Sentinel.
Yes.
Has something similar at the end of the second adventure where you have to defend the small keep from an invading fire giant and his hobgoblin allies. It was a similar kind of thing where I had the miniatures set up in the big battle. I like the big grand set pieces. It's always fun. And I love dungeons. To me, the dungeon is my favorite adventure environment. Probably second would be something urban. Because basically urban, especially if you have like the sewers or the alleys, it's kind
it
of
is
like
an outdoor
dungeon. Yeah, it is a dungeon. I always like that kind of environment. So which is probably why I'm not as strong an adventure writer as I wish I was, because for me, when I write my adventures for my personal use, I like designing a dungeon and just kind of having vague notes and everything, and then watching the players, what they do in reaction to it.
Yeah.
So to me, it's not, my writing isn't what's interesting to me, it's watching how things change because of the players.
Well, what's interesting, this is a little bit of a side note, but Mike and I recently participated in a, we went back and we played OD&D, the original D&D, white book D&D. And Mike threw together an adventure, because none of us, nobody else could parse the rules. And I don't know how long you spent on conceptualizing
an
that
hour.
Adventure.
An yeah. hour.
But it had this very compelling story attached to what was mm-hmm. essentially just a dungeon. The dungeon map was randomly generated.
Yeah, made a random dungeon map.
And then once he had that, he just created this, he just wove this story around about it, and I found that to be as compelling an idea for a dungeon as I'd seen in a long, long time. And I think part of it was just rooted in its fundamental simplicity, that you, everything, there was no huge mystery to, the mystery was in the dungeon itself. And discovering what was going on there and why this group over this part of the dungeon was fighting with this group over this part of the dungeon and getting tangled up in that tension. So, I mentioned that apropos of nothing.
I'd like
everything I say.
How about you guys?
I think one of my favorite adventures goes is Bruce Cordell's Return to the Tomb of Horrors. Because it was the perfect mix of old school and what was then new school design, and it was just fantastic. We had a great time. We played the entire thing, and I think the big sexy part of that adventure was the fact that it was so big, and it was such an investment, and I got buy-ins from everybody else. It was a very compelling story. It was easy to adapt to my own setting, and it was really fantastic. In third edition, Forge of Fury was one of my favorites. I felt that was a really, really tightly written adventure. You felt like you were changing, you know, it was all one complex. It felt big. There was a lot of space to explore, and then it all, and as you went down, it got more complicated and more challenging. In fact, there was Rich did a dangerous thing by having a inappropriate CR monster, the Roper, that was off in the side tunnel, which my group
with a little sidebar to the DM saying,
"Don't
hey.
Do this." and you know, your stuff, yeah, I'm going to suck up a little bit. Lich Queen's Beloved was that was yours, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
I love that adventure a great deal
from Dungeon 100.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Go kick the Githyanki Lich Queen's ass.
That was pretty cool.
That was pretty much the plot, too.
Yep. But that was an adventure that was a huge epic scope, right? An epic, not in the sense of 21st level, but it was big. It was a world-changing event, and it was you get to explore an alien environment, lots of really compelling NPCs, lots of great support stuff to it, a lot of takeaway. I tend to look for things that I can reuse out of an adventure, that I can steal for whatever else.
That reminds me of a quick point. One of the things that I think defines a strong adventure, and something I always try to do in my design is to, even when I fail, is to create cool, iconic images that players can remember. From that adventure, one of the things I remember most is there was an evil Githyanki wizard who had no legs. He's basically a paraplegic wizard who got around by levitation. But just the image of having to do battle with this legless, floating Lich Githyanki guy or whatever he was just sort of struck a chord with me. Noonan put a blind troll in his Shattered Gates of Slaughtergard adventure when we were playtesting that struck me as memorable because I had never seen that before. Mm-hmm. It's like the four-armed gargoyle in Tomb of Horrors. Gargoyles can have four arms?
Yeah.
Oh my god, that's so cool.
I'm pretty sure I did a follow-up to your adventure in Scales of War. I had the spine of Lacketh. It was just
that's
your backbone
right.
that was floating in the room.
Yes, it was like a Borg Queen thing. It was awesome.
I've never played it, but I really like the original Ravenloft because I like the interesting card elements that would change the story somewhat.
Yeah.
I thought that really appeals to my sense of story and to just a weird... I hadn't seen anything like that before at that point.
I don't think there's any adventure I've run more often.
Me too.
Ravenloft.
I've run it for every edition so far.
Yeah,
I've never run it or played it.
Yeah, I
read it when we were designing the board game.
Yeah, and it sort of does what Tomb of Horrors does for the horror from the Gothic horror genre. Mm-hmm. It sort of defined that genre.
Yeah.
Anything that you would do that has to do with a vampire in a castle would just be a ripoff.
Yeah, yeah. As for stuff I've played, I have a lot of nostalgic feelings toward stuff like my cousin was my first real DM, and he used to run stuff like The Assassin's Knot, I remember, and Island of Dread, and Keep on the Borderlands. The adventure I really want to play that I think, like Ravenloft, is just really interesting and weird is Expedition to the Barrier Peaks.
Yes.
Another one that I really like, I think when one of the design tests that I got, it was like, what adventure would you do if you could turn an adventure into 4th edition? And I said, Expedition to the Barrier Peaks. And it was like, why? And I was like,
it's got freaking lasers.
It's got lasers and aliens. And I was like, and you could bring back Star Frontiers.
Star Frontiers.
And
one of my favorites. Yeah. How about you guys? What are the adventures that strike you as most impressionable or sort of defining of D&D?
For me, my very first one actually was 2nd edition. My first exposure was Haunted Halls of the Evening Star.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That has always just been the quintessential adventure.
What made that the quintessential adventure? Was it because you had a great experience the first time around?
Partly because it was, you know, it recaptures that feeling of the whole game being new, but I think just the whole, I had always heard, you know, I'd never played D&D, so I'd always heard about you crawling around in dungeons and you're fighting all these monsters and there's puzzles and traps at every turn, and this has exactly that.
Yeah.
I just cleared that room. Oh, wait, I left something in that room. I had to go back in. And the room could be completely different, or the traps have all reset, or the green ooze is back on the ceiling again. You never know.
Yeah.
Planescape. Playing old PC games is what got me into D&D, and Planescape, the whole camp and all the lingo in that universe is just so unique to me.
Yeah.
And it pulls you in, and everybody is dirty and everybody is shady. Even though it kind of seems like there's all this sameness, it just really set it apart from everything else. So
yeah.
I'd like to see more of that.
I think, you know, I still think that Planescape Torment is one of the best computer RPGs that I've ever played. It's like in my top two or three.
It is.
It's really, really good.
Yeah, they did something really remarkable with that setting in terms of making it literally unlike anything D&D had ever tried to tinker with before, with all the philosophy built in, and like you say, just altering the language of the whole gaming experience. I think it was off-putting for a lot of people, which is why they didn't know how to deal with it. Like, to actually run it, it takes some investment, but wow. Yeah. Other adventures? Let me switch the question around. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I started with basic, and most of the early basic ones were really good. Of course, I'm a young player. I love B1. It's almost no story. The story is what's not there. The two guys, Rogar.
Zaladar.
I can't remember the name.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the wizard and the fighter, they weren't even there. So we're sneaking around this place forever because it's the biggest dungeon I've ever been in, waiting to find these guys. And like we're sneaking around somebody's bedroom finding all the cool stuff. You know, that kind of Indiana Jones-ish thing was really good. And B5, you know, even though it was basic, it was out.
Horror on the Hill.
Yeah, Horror on the Hill. That whole almost sandbox
feel.
That game, I felt anything could happen.
Yeah.
At first level. And of course, you do have a lot of, you know, things that didn't.
I had a lot of sort of prejudice early on about basic. It'd be basic. I wanted just, you know, it was advanced all the time. But then, because I was a completist, I started to pick up the basic adventures after a couple of years and realized what I was missing. A ton of good stuff. We were just drooling all over Rahaja, B7.
Such a fantastic adventure.
Yeah. It's another Tracy Hickman, Laura Hickman.
Yeah, and I think you said, but Horror on the Hill, one of the things I like, because I played through that. And if I remember right, there's one scene where, like, you confront the Hobgoblin King and he pulls a switch and you fall through to level 2 of the dungeon and you can't get back out. We actually had to go all the way through level 2, all the way through level 3, fight a dragon, go down a river, get out, then go back over land to the dungeon to get the Hobgoblin King. Because that jerk threw us in level 2 and we were mad. Like a month of gaming trying to get back to kill him.
Well, the fact that you went back there to get him says something.
We were a spiteful 12-year-olds.
It's still appealing. The last day of school I teach, the last day of school last year, I had brought in a bunch of kids in my room, and we played that all day.
Oh, that's awesome.
And they had the greatest time ever. They never played D&D before.
Oh, wow.
That's
thank
wonderful.
Thank you.
It still has a lot of mileage to it.
Wow. So you're wearing a Kiss shirt, so you have good taste in music. And
thank you. I'm kind of stuck in that certain time.
I'm the same. I have Zeppelin and Kiss on my
aren't we all?
So, having talked about our favorite adventures, let's talk a little about what makes a good one and what makes a bad one. Because, actually, let me frame this. How many of you write adventures? how many?
Yeah.
Any adventures.
Incomplete.
Yeah. Incomplete adventures, doesn't matter. How many of you are here because you've wanted to but have been hesitant to? Okay. All right. I suspect that everybody in this room has an opinion about what makes a good adventure and what makes a bad adventure, however. Raise your hand if you have an opinion about what makes a good adventure. Okay. Would you mind, in the back there, telling me one of the things that you think makes a good adventure? And then I'll hit a few other folks.
Decision points, which are actual decision points, and not just
thrust on you?
Not just pretending to be decision points. You know what I mean? There's a lot of bad adventures I've played where, it's like, let's make a deal. Door number one, door number two, door number three. But door number one and door number three will eventually just take you to door number two.
Yeah. Choices that aren't choices.
Journey to the Rock.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, sadly, if I had to come up...
You don't have to go to the middle, game's over.
Yeah. If I had to come up with the worst adventure, published adventure, that might be it. And no offense to whoever wrote it.
Forest Oracle was pretty special, too.
Forest Oracle was special.
Just the language.
I was crying that day in the N-World.
Yeah. Some of the other folks had their hands up? Yeah.
I would echo that. I think that's really important. The players really feel like they're making real decisions. That's good. But also, I think an adventure has to meet the needs of the players. Mm-hmm. That a good adventure is not a sort of an objective thing. It's a very immutable thing that will depend a lot on whether the adventure is a good fit for the characters, for the players rather, and their characters that they've generated and so on.
Yeah.
So in writing, particularly when you're writing for your own group, in a sense you're at an advantage because you really understand that group and you understand their needs, and we talked earlier in the other seminar about creating sort of spotlight moments for your adventurers, so you can work their backstories into it and make it very meaningful, so that those choices are not only meaningful within the context of the adventure, but also meaningful in terms of the development of characters. And of course, in a published adventure, you're kind of imagining your sort of ideal player and sort of trying to meet their needs. But
sometimes you don't know too. Like I remember running a published Ravenloft adventure called The Created for my players, and they hated it. They hated being turned into puppets.
Was that like half the Ravenloft adventures though?
Ravenloft adventures, that one basically broke Ravenloft for my party. I took them through the adventure because conceptually it sounded so cool. The characters are trapped in this domain. This evil puppet turns them into puppets like him, and he wants to be a real person. It's a Ravenloft riff on Pinocchio. A lot of the Ravenloft adventures sort of riffed on basic stories. Like Frankenstein and stuff like that. And they were so put off by that experience that I could not even bring another Ravenloft adventure to the table. They hated being their characters being transformed in that particular way and being kind of not what they envisioned their characters to be.
Well, I think that's important. No player character likes to have... That's all they have in this world, right? And having that sort of taken away from them, that's all a bit of a no-brainer. Sense.
I thought it'd be fun, you get to play puppets for a while, you have to figure out a way to turn yourselves back, but for this particular group of players, it'd probably work fine with the groups I'm running now, but didn't work back then.
We had a very similar experience with Bleak House.
With
the whole torture scene where your characters are trapped and then you have to undergo through these trials and stuff, and they were done with Ravenloft forever. one adventure, that was it.
Did you get a comment right here?
Yeah.
During the DMing part, you were talking about you would have like three different storylines that could be mingled through at any given time, depending on what the characters decide to do. I think having a sort of an amorphous story like that and making it basically letting the players choose where they go and letting it form as they make it and not having a rigid structure.
Yeah. Now, I know some people, they don't get to play, they don't have the luxury of being able to sustain a long campaign because they play infrequently, and so standalone adventures become their D&D fix, and it can be hard to conceptualize these three big story arcs where big things are going on and be able to sustain that over a period of time, but it is a nice luxury if you have it. Other things that make a good adventure?
like you said, like the legless wizard, I think something that's memorable, that's just completely says, oh, that was the one adventure where whatever. Like for me, like yes. The book The Hobbit, where the trolls argue till the sun comes up. That was, I mean, of all the things that happened in that book, that's the one thing when somebody mentions The Hobbit, I think of that. So an adventure that has something like that that just blatantly sticks out being memorable, and as long as the players get to be an integral part of that moment, I think that makes an adventure really great.
Yes. Just as a quick question quiz here, for those of you who are familiar with it, tell me, just off the top of your head, the most iconic image that springs to mind when I say Tomb of Horrors. Anyone?
Demi Lich.
Yeah.
Demi Lich?
Sphere of Annihilation.
Sphere, yes. The green devil face. That's what pops into my mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Me too.
Yeah, and the hallway with all the sort of hieroglyphs and so on.
Yeah.
That, the image that was provided for the original adventure.
White Plume Mountain. Anyone?
That room that has all the tears.
Yes, the ziggurat room with the creatures in it. The swinging chains that you have to get to get to the where the vampires. The giant crab and the big bubble.
Yeah.
Expedition to the Barrier Peaks.
Frog Hemoth!
Big giant frog mutated monster. Veggie pygmies running around, stabbing you with little short spears. Robot android guy throwing you barbells.
The weird alien skeletons, the skulls were just different enough that you could tell they weren't human.
Yes.
But
Lost Caverns of Sajkhan.
Oh, the sphere room at the very bottom. I mean, come on.
That was awesome. Vampire girl sleeping on the beer.
That pops out the Zeggy and the Zeggya.
The Zeggya and the Zeggya. Yeah, you awesome. Got it. Yeah, absolutely.
One hell of a fight.
Okay.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
No resistance. There are a number of these iconic images that pop up, and you know they make common experience. We can talk about these adventures because we know what these things mean. That's one of the hallmarks of a great adventure.
Nobody said it. To me, a mystery. You have to have a mystery to solve because the question moves the story forward.
Yes.
Characters know what they have to do next. Even if they're stuck, they know they have something to solve.
Right.
We don't know this. We've got to find it.
It doesn't always have to be a big mystery, but there has to be something to drive their curiosity.
You need conflict of some sort.
Yeah. Conflict.
By conflict, that just means something that opposes desire.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
right. Any other things before we...
I think player investment. The player has to be invested in whatever is happening. Not necessarily in like a grand story, because sometimes the grand story is the DM kind of telling you what's going on, but really the story I look at it more of like what you see as actually happening, the player himself as he's moving through it. That's the actual story. Everything else is just fluff.
Yeah. Yeah, just, I mean, sometimes you'll just go through the Tomb of Horrors in a night because you want to just see how long your characters last before they die. And that's a perfectly good experience, too. Yeah.
I think a good adventure at some point has a sense of anticipation about something. Which is what I don't care how cliche it is. I like any adventure where I know there's going to be a big freaking dragon at the end. It doesn't matter how cliche it is, as long as I know there's some fire breathing reptile at the end of this thing, I'm here.
Can anyone name three adventures where that's actually true?
Horror on the Hill.
Horror on the Hill?
Because it's a dragon.
The Kobold adventure that was with the DMG.
Forge of Fury.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Forge of Fury.
Dragon Mountain.
Dragon Mountain box set.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Bastion of Broken Souls.
Mm-hmm. In almost every one of the Dragonlance adventures.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Return to the Tomb of Horrors at the opposite, where in the Moat House, the dragon was the first thing you fought.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Or that was...
Temple of Omens.
Temple of Omens. Oh, yeah, right. I want to say I see Tomb of Horrors.
Yeah.
Fourth edition DMG character.
Yep.
Adventure.
Yep.
That's right. Or Rondar the Big Blue.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's a really good one.
Something I like about... I hate to keep coming back to basic, but I've been all the way through before we moved on to...
D&D is D&D.
When we got the companion level, there are things in the published adventures that gave me things instead of just go kill, take treasure, or do good, that good feeling. I mean, you would end up with a kingdom.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, things like that. Or you could end up with a noble title. Or things like that that would change the character.
That's a really good point.
Instead of just, I took, I had fun, but now I am different.
Yeah.
When I revamped the Against the Giant series for 4th edition on a whim, one of the things I did was in one of the dungeons there is a, and I think this is present in the original too, there's a captive storm giant, a female storm giant who's being held captive. And I added the idea that if you rescued her, that her father would basically give you a storm tower, a tower on a cloud that you could use as a mobile base in your campaign.
Who would want to play that?
And I actually provided it in the adventure, and you can use it, you know, on subsequent adventures. It's a toy that players get that goes beyond their typical rewards, and it's just neat.
Yeah.
Never had one of those before. and it's eminently attackable, which is a good thing for the DM, too.
Yeah.
So.
You got it
now,
home.
Better than a flying carpet.
Yeah.
Because I'm already getting
it. Well, like when you're talking about the companion series, there's a venture called Test of the Warlord.
That's one thing.
Yeah, it had that, and one of the things I liked was one of the. It basically, you're given a place to colonize, a village of the barony. And one of the things I liked about it was it was these separate little episodes you would go through, and one of them was like these wandering barbarians come through, and you can go to like their big meeting. And if you do well there and impress them later on when the frost giants invade, you can send an emissary to the barbarians, say, hey, since we're blood brothers, we need help, and the barbarians show up, an army shows up to help you defend your castle.
Yeah.
Just that feeling of it's a world, it's a breathing world that you're interacting with, and you're really immersed in it. You know that, and the opposite was true if you screwed up and they hated you. Well, I think they would come and attack you, like, you know, they'd help the frost giants, things like that. You can see the repercussions of your actions mm-hmm. across the campaign. It really brings it to life.
One of the best things I was just reminded of that ties into this is it is a common adventure trope to look for the artifact. Hunting the, there are like 7 possible D&D adventure plots, one of which is get the artifact. And you could probably distill down every other Dungeon Dragons adventure into one of the 7. You know, rescue X.
Prevent X ritual.
Escape this. There's only like a half dozen, maybe slightly more, that exist. And every adventure that's ever been done is basically mixed and matched these, or taken one and really sort of run with it. But one of the ones that always, I wouldn't say teed me off or anything, but often told me whether an adventure was good or great was, you have to find the artifact. You find the artifact, adventure's over.
That was Treasure Talon Pass.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's better to find that artifact halfway through the adventure so that you can use it for the other half of the adventure. I can't tell you how many adventures I used to see in Dungeon Magazine that ended on, which were basically artifact hunts that ended with the finding of an artifact with no idea of what the players could possibly do with it or that they would even bother to keep it. But I think part of the cool thing about D&D is finding stuff that you think is too powerful and wielding that shit.
Morrowind, you said, what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like Morrowind, you got to get several items to go find.
And I do that all the time in my campaign. They find things, they use them, and I know that they can be unbalanced. I adjust the campaign to compensate, or I let them stomp through for a while before, you know, whatever. Part of the joy of being a player in these things are finding the toys and using them. And a lot of adventures forget that, and they don't let you do the second thing.
Yeah. So you brought up Morrowind. I think that as a console game, I played it on the Xbox, had a great thing going where your characters, you play through, it turns out you're like the Messiah-type figure. And it was really fun watching how the NPCs you met would change in their reactions. Yes. As you progressed through the game, you became famous. And maybe not always, or maybe infamous, depending on how people viewed you.
Right.
And I think that feedback in an adventure, it's pretty easy as a DM to implement, but it makes the adventure come to life. Like, when people say, oh, you're the guys who killed, you know, I used to love doing that in my campaigns, where, like, you know, if the characters killed some NPC, the people, oh, you're the guy who killed that evil guy, are really happy, and, you know, maybe the villagers or people in town throw a party, and then after the party that night, when the characters are all drunk, the assassin sent by the guy's brother shows up and tries to kill them, and it's not all, you know, sunshine and roses for the heroes.
That sounds like what someone mentioned at the early choices that matter.
Exactly. Yes.
Just 3 doors that take the same place.
Yeah.
In the adventure, if they do this, these things follow. If they do that, those things follow, and not, you can't go back to that point again.
Exactly. It's kind of like the adventure Chris mentioned that I ran for OD&D had these 2 bands of wizards in the dungeon, and they're the black wizards and the white wizards, just based on how they dressed, and they're from this really distant city where everyone was a wizard, and they wore these weird masks. Now, you guys didn't actually meet them, but the idea was I didn't really cast the black guys. The black wizards weren't evil, necessarily. The white wizards weren't necessarily good. They were both fairly neutral. It was really up to the characters to determine how they wanted to interact with them. You know, when they first met them, well, what happens next? It's all the players drive that. But I would keep in mind, knowing these two groups of mages hate each other. So if you ally with the white wizards, the black wizards are probably going to hate you, unless you try to betray the white wizard and, you know, kind of set the characters up to do whatever they wanted to do and let the adventure respond to that.
And part of it was, I'm sure, Mike not having any expectations about what we were going to do ahead of time.
Exactly.
So he just rolled with the punches.
Yeah.
Something you had mentioned that sparked something, and now it's completely slipped my mind. It'll come back to me, though, I hope, soon. So I'll move on.
I think to go back to the idea that you were talking about, the choices that matter, I think that it's that one of the hallmarks for a great adventure for me is that every action that happens in the game has a consequence. So that the story shapes in a different way. Now, for writing a published adventure, it's not always possible because there's only so much space to work with. And if you try to cover every possible range of consequence that would happen from, well, they didn't, you know, you either have a lot of dead encounter spaces or so on. So it's a challenge for me as a designer to kind of work my way through that. But for the games I run for myself, or when I do design, it's really, it's the number one concern, is that everything I want to do in the adventure is to set up situations where the adventure changes based on what the characters do. And I'm not tooting my own horn in it, but I will say that in Bark of the Moon, with one of those adventures for Dungeon Magazine, where I really focused hard on saying, all right, I want to create a situation where you've got the situation, and then how the players interact with this world and with this challenge will alter the outcome of the adventure in a meaningful way. And that was it ended up being 3 times longer than it was supposed to be, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, piggybacking off of what Rob's talking about in running games, it's like I always want the players to surprise me. I'm kind of disappointed if things go as I planned, because I could have just written it down, and you know, and I know what it's going to be. And if the players make an interesting choice, I usually have enough developed that I can go off in that direction. And by the end of the evening, I'm really surprised too because of how, you know, how their choices have affected it. But in writing adventures, especially the stuff I'm working on right now, I've felt really like my hands are tied because of the space. I have a limited amount of space to work with. You know, I have a subject I've got to work with. You know, certain things have got to happen. And I've been trying to push as many meaningful choices into it as possible. But there are some battles, I think, in it that I just have to say, okay, I'm just going to surrender to this and know that this adventure kind of needs to go this way and try to make other choices inside of it interesting.
Embedding choices into the yes. You may have a linear progression of the adventure, but you can embed choices inside of those scenes so that it makes the scene unfold in a different way, even though the scene will progress more or less in the way that you have with the space you have to work in.
Yes, that's so much more eloquently than I put it. But yes.
And some adventure writing assignments have some very unusual constraints, like the D&D encounter season. Here you are designing an encounter season adventure that's supposed to span 13 weeks of play with a different session every week. They're sequential, and the group changes every week. So you have to have these sort of finite start and end points all the way through. That creates a very bizarre constraint to the designer of that scenario that wouldn't normally exist in an adventure you'd be running for a game group that remained more or less the same all the way throughout.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So another hallmark of a good adventure is that when failure actually has a consequence. When the PCs fail, the adventure doesn't end, but actually it almost starts at that point. I think it was a adventure series I had had overlooked when we were talking about our favorite adventures with the Slaver series. So at the end of A3,
you get captured,
you have to kind of dig your way out, and it was just fantastic because, you know, you failed, but now's your chance for redemption. And that's pretty powerful. I think for writing adventures on, you know, now I'm really trying to find ways to create situations where it can be that the PCs fail, and that, well, how would the adventure change? And I go back to World's Largest Dungeon. I wrote the very bottom right hand corner, and that was where there was a Zil guy, and he's slayed a bunch of Dwagar, and they're digging out to dig pig to this this prison that's holding a bunch of devils. And so I built in the adventure that you have all these encounters with the Darrow and the Dwagar and all that stuff. And at the very end, if you fail, they all come out, and I give you guidelines for how you replace the encounters with these monsters. And so it could shift based on how, you know, your timing. And it was interesting. I'd like to do something more of that, but, you know.
You know what? I was one of the designers on the Madness at Gardmore Abbey, which is September. Is that right?
I think that's right.
Somewhere around then. And I, when I was doing my section of it, I kept thinking I have a player named Lowell who every time he comes to a new part of an adventure, he goes, you know, what can we do, you know, like to avoid combat and like find another way around it? And I was, and then the players all put their heads together, and they usually look for an alternative means to do it, I guess just to keep them amused and move their story forward. So I don't know if what it will be in its final version, but I believe that almost every encounter that I designed has an alternative way that you can go about solving it or doing so, or interacting with it. At least that was my goal, because, you know, every time.
That's exactly why we thought you'd be a good choice for the next encounter season.
Okay.
Right.
But yeah, I always think, well, what would Lowell do? How would he try to screw me if I was running this live? And and he would be like, let me see, what can we do with this here? So when if you play that, like, know that you don't, at least in my sections, you don't have to hack everything. There's usually some thing you can do.
Yeah. I was going to say, the point I'd forgotten to mention earlier, and I can't remember what point it actually tied to. I think it was something Mike said, but it was about, well, I don't remember who said it, but a point I did want to raise is the tier system in 4th edition has, I think, created some interesting expectations about what adventurers should be doing at each of those tiers. And if you have your epic characters, you know, defending villages because their cattle is being abducted, that can cause some problems. And the reason I say it is because often in the magazines when we get submissions to Dungeon Magazine for Adventures, there's often a disconnect between what the characters are asked to do and the level at which the adventure is set. And I think it's important to keep that in mind, that particularly with 4th edition, Paragon-level heroes should be doing Paragon-level things, Epic-level heroes should be doing Epic-level things and feeling epic. And now I remember what point it ties to. It ties to the idea that when your epic characters go through town, the NPCs in that town should look at them differently from when they walk through that same town 15 levels earlier. That a good adventure accounts for that change. It realizes it sets things up so the DM knows that the NPCs, the PCs have accomplished something, ergo this place is not the same place they remember. And you can do some very interesting things just with character interactions by keeping the level of the characters in mind and how they should be treated.
One comment based on what Steve said about having these branching off, you know, decision points and everything you were talking about. One thing that I really like about adventure, and this was, I started with first edition, so the 32-page adventure, one thing that it did is it made the DM have to improvise a lot of what, because they couldn't put everything in there, just 32 pages. And one thing that I like about some adventures is that it gives meat to the DM that he can use. It gives him ideas, but it doesn't necessarily give him a specific systematic, this is how you would do X. It just gives him enough for him to hang himself. just enough so that he can improvise based on a broad idea instead of just basically specifics of that idea.
That's a really good point.
I'm
trying to think of the 32-page adventures. They had, more often than not, I don't know how they did it exactly, but I rarely found myself struggling with most of them. Like, there was always just enough information I found. Like, even against the giants
or slavers,
which is so spare.
They don't give you much, but with that, you have so much to do with.
Yeah.
In my very limited space for the thing that I've been working on, I've
I know that I have limited space and I want there to be some role-playing involved, so I had written, I don't know if this will work, but I had written that this NPC likes these characters and dislikes these characters, and here's why. Here's the information on the NPC. Yeah. When you come up to the NPC, if one of these characters is in the party, they greet you by saying this. If one of these characters approaches, she says this. And then I say, you know, role-play that scene. You know, like, and let the characters make their skill checks or whatever, while it's my way of trying to make the skill challenge organic. Mm-hmm. So that it doesn't feel like a skill challenge. You're talking to her, and then, oh, well, you know, da, 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 oh, so-and-so's here. Well, now the DC is a little harder. And hopefully the DM will be looked at the block of little stuff about the NPC, have, you know, used the line of dialogue to open the conversation. It's my starting scene line, and then that role-playing scene is there for you to play. And I haven't listed, she knows these five things, she will do these five things. It's just you got the block of text. It's like you said, you know how what their attitude is, and you know what they know, basically, and go.
There were a lot of adventures that used to do that kind of thing where they put in, like, here are three things that this NPC might say. Mm-hmm. Just mm-hmm. quotes. Mm-hmm. I know some Planescape stuff did this and others, and it just gave you enough of an understanding of what the character was all about that you could sort of take it from there.
Indeed, and that's what I hope I've done in these little paragraphs. I've been like, you know, she's married to so-and-so, but she's upset. I always, like, I do this in my own games, too. I usually say, back when I was acting, because I love talking about that, in one class, I had a really good teacher who was like, where's your vulnerability? Where's your vulnerability? Where's your vulnerability? And I'd be like, and she'd be like, you need to be, every character needs to be vulnerable. Because that, and it doesn't mean, you know, stat-wise, it means, like, what is it that pierces and affects that character? Even the most, you know, dour, hardy dwarf has something that's going to affect them. And so whenever I write an NPC description, I write out what their weakness is. I don't say weakness, write it out. I say, like, she's afraid that her relationship with so-and-so will cause her to break her vows to whatever. And yet she wants to commit to so-and-so. And so, as a DM, you know what that scene is. You've seen it on TV in every show that you watch. You know, it's coded into our dramatic understanding of how things work.
You had mentioned Ravenloft as one of your favorite adventures. That's one of my favorite. I'm actually running kind of like a rip-off of it here this weekend. But if the villain in that adventure has a vulnerability that the players get to find, and they find the tome. And there's a lot of it there that it doesn't give you a lot, but it gives the DM enough that he can say, if he wants to ham it up, he can.
He's a goosebump talking about that. Mm-hmm. He loves that girl, that long-dead mm-hmm. girl. And that she's what? Incarnate.
Correct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Love it.
Yeah. And frankly, that's what has made Strahd stand the test of time. Mm-hmm. We look at the most iconic characters in any character in D&D. Strahd's got to be in the top 10 somewhere.
Mm-hmm. It's the first one that I wasn't allowed to kill.
And everything else I faced before Ravenloft killed it. I got to him, killing. And it was that became a different story.
Yeah.
I actually got defeated. I was either dead or won up to the point.
Yeah. And there's something to sympathize with him, whether it's the DM sympathizing or the players or both. So mm-hmm. that's it. I'm trying to think of other villains that have been created over the course of D&D's adventuring legacy that have anywhere close to Strahd's complexity.
Casey and Laura did a good job with that.
Yeah.
They did the real good.
I think some of the Dragon Lords in the Dragonlance, Kitiara.
That's a good one. Yeah.
I'm not sure if we interact with her so much through the modules as we do the novels. Because, Lord Soth is the same kind of way.
Yeah.
But he's...
They did a good job of Lord Toad, too, actually.
Lord Toad, yeah.
Yeah.
There's Manchun in Forgotten Realms.
Right.
He's quite an mm-hmm. evil character. Yeah. But he was much more sort of two-dimensional than some
of
the
ones.
Yeah.
Rary.
Rary?
Rary the Traitor. He was pretty cool. For me.
Yeah. Interesting. There's not a ton of them.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm trying to think of who's really strong and you sympathize with or feel for.
really get to meet and interact with and understand.
Yeah. Meepo. You can't forget Meepo.
No, I can't.
We've talked a little bit about the constraints of, or the difficulties and challenges of writing to a format without going into great details. I'm just wondering, since a lot of you have had exposure to third and fourth edition adventure formats, what you think of the tactical format in general. Because it started off as an experiment in 3rd edition, and it just sort of graduated onto 4th edition, that we would set up encounters in essentially spreads so that you had all the information you need in front of you, and you didn't have to do a lot of backflipping or whatever. Occasionally, we had to make you do some flipping, but the intention was minimize the amount of searching for information, and it's created a very rigid template. What do you guys think about it? Yeah. We're getting some way hands sort of shifting side to side. Yes, ma'am. Yep.
Because 4th edition is the first organized play I've actually played. I've done mostly home games, but it's also the first time I've judged, and I find it very helpful.
Yeah.
Because that was my home DM's main complaint. All the work she had to put into it, because she's also a teacher. So doing all the work, so we had to do long spans in between, so she had time to do all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I like the how it's all together.
I'm half and half, and it's because the format is great when you're at the table and you're actually running that encounter.
Yeah.
But it makes it feel that those are the only things that happen in that adventure, because it constricts the space that you have to actually put information in to such a small amount of time. You're taking 2 pages, the encounter's taking at least 2 pages of information. And a lot of the in-betweens of those get kind of lost in that format.
I think there's a encounter in Gardmore where I said I got to the end of my space, and then I said, if they really want to fight these guys, they're in this book, they're in Monster Manual 3, because I didn't think that it's not designed to be a fighting encounter, so putting those stat blocks on the page was like,
yeah,
you know, would have really, I think, limited the encounter.
It's a topic of ongoing conversation because around the Wizard's office, because we're constantly evaluating our formats and how they're being received. I'm sorry, you have a question?
I was just saying, sort of with Vic, I like it when I'm actually at the table and running a combat, especially if it's something like a convention here where I've run it 2 or 3 times, so I know the storyline of the content by heart. I don't need that anymore. I only need the stat blocks. But I find that when prepping an adventure the first time, you know, I kind of want to read... They meet the guy, they talk to him, it evolves into combat, and here's where the combat goes. And I find that flipping back and forth in prep time, there tends to be a little bit distracting because it's so disjointed to try and read through.
The current season of Keep on the Borderlands right now, one thing that I think that Chris did really well was he gives you some information. For example, when you find the lizard folk, he gives you some information about the lizard folk, how they're going to react, and he gives you that ahead of time in the kind of like in the summary parts of the adventure. When you get to the encounters, you're basically just running encounter. And an adventure that was like that, I think it was Expedition to the Dim and Wet Pits, the 3rd edition hardback, and Castle Ravenloft did the same thing. And some of the encounters, I think I believe that they were put. All the encounter stuff
at the end.
Back, and it was a pain to actually work with that for the DM to actually do that. But I think that it provided the adventure a lot more flexibility to be able to give you a sense of what's happening without actually having to break it with there's an encounter and here's all the stuff that's in it.
Right. I think one of the things we've identified as a flaw of the early 4th edition adventures is that the adventures were basically built as a series of these spreads, and every encounter was designed not only to fill the space, but also to be level appropriate. And so you went from encounter to encounter, and the tension of the adventure was pretty level all the way through. You didn't get these spikes, these easy fights that the characters felt really comfortable and confident just mowing down the bad guys, and then these really tough fights. There's none of this going on. And so I think the philosophy is changing now, where we're trying to... It's not something we intended. It's something that happened because of the format. And designers felt like that they had 2 pages, this encounter has to deliver this much oomph, you know, encounter after encounter. And now we're thinking, okay, how do we live within this format and also have the encounter with the two orc minion guards standing outside the door that you just want to sneak past to get into the dungeon without alerting everybody beyond. You know, you're not going to devote a two-page spread to that. Where does that information reside that's comfortable for the DM?
Is there a reason why, for example, and I go back to first edition, just gave you orc, 8 hit points, etc., etc. Is there a reason why Wizard specifically wants to give you the whole stat block for that adventure in that space instead of referring you somewhere else? Or putting it somewhere else in the adventure?
Convenience. That's really the only answer there. Just making sure that the DM has literally everything they need and there is no flipping to other books. That's it. And it's an open question about whether the trade, whether that's worth it, whether that provides.
And I think that when you talked about, we're basically all of a sudden we're in an encounter that we're like, hold on a second, this is not. A good example is in Ravenloft. Once again, Strahd is placed randomly based on what your fortunes are. I had one game where one player, they came in and Strahd is like in the third room. And one of the players says, that can't be Strahd. It's too early to be Strahd. And it becomes one of those things.
Oh my God, it's Strahd, run away, run away.
So it creates an immediate tension because it's a completely unexpected situation.
Yes. Sorry.
You're absolutely
that was
right.
Too much.
I'd like to see more of the, I mean, this is probably not a format issue, although I'd like to see more skill challenges with, you know, the two orc guards standing at the door combined with a skill challenge, that kind of thing where you're building things together. And I don't know if, you know, putting the two orcs at the end of the book would be helpful or not. But having these sort of hybrid encounters, certainly my players really enjoy those kinds of things where different players are doing different kinds of things, not just kind of like whack. Where they feel like they're really accomplishing a goal.
Would it be possible to do, I don't know if this makes any sense to anybody but me, but you write out your adventure, and then we're talking about the two-page spread, it's just a little number, that's number 5. And then at the back, the last 10, 15 page, whatever, there's your two-page spreads you turn to.
Yeah.
But you've got the entire story, so you can fit in what you're saying about the two guards in a story that the DM reads. And then you go back to the spreads for the details.
Yeah. We've got a few adventures out there that use that format. We've kind of experimented over the life of this edition and late third edition, but there are adventures out there that actually do that, where all of that stuff is up front, and then the encounters are just pushed to the back, like we did it with a number of the Expedition 2 series for third edition. And I don't know if that's a better format than what we're using now for some upcoming encounter seasons, which is that there are some encounters that only have a page or less, some encounters that have multiple pages, and we thread the encounter spreads throughout the book. In some cases, we blow up an encounter spread into a 4-page entry. The first 2 pages basically give you the background for whatever you need. Maybe there's a skill challenge that precedes the encounter that sort of determines exactly what's going to happen during the encounter, and then it's followed by the 2-page spread encounter, which might require, which you will adjust based on the outcome of the skill challenge, things like that. We're constantly playing with these formats to try to come up with the magic formula.
One thing we identified as a need in those adventures was to have more exploration. Sections where there's just an empty room with a skeleton line in it, and you
yes.
can kind of poke around, see is there any treasure in it or any secret doors, rather than having every room have an encounter. That format allows us to provide interesting features in a dungeon or an area and make it feel a little bit more alive.
I don't want to be critical, but that 4E feels like it's left that kind of to the side, that exploration thing. That when I talk about Horror on the Hill, I didn't know what the encounter was until after it kicked my butt.
Right.
Now, this was important. Yeah. You know, you just didn't know. But maybe that's just the...
We've identified it as an issue. We're certainly aware of it. It's just we're wrestling with it, so trying to beat it into submission.
One thing that I've noticed, and I noticed this when the game came out, is that the explanation of the skill challenges in the DMG was explaining a framework, but it really didn't do a good job of explaining this is just a framework, and this is for you to kind of play with and try to figure out how to do it. And a lot of the adventures, we do a lot of organized play, a lot of the adventures basically kind of became, okay, this is the skill challenge, and these are the only skills that you can use, et cetera, et cetera. Have you guys maybe looked at a way of maybe, and I've read your articles about it, and have you guys maybe made a way of maybe looking at that in the adventures? I remember the box set, the red box set, has the skill challenge, and it's organized in a way that's a little bit different, and it gives the DM a lot more information. It's the encounter with the dragon.
Yeah.
Gives a little bit more information that actually allows the DM to be flexible with, instead of just this rigid arcana, DC-12, et cetera, et cetera.
I followed the same thing up in the sequel to it in Dungeon Magazine. Mm-hmm. The sequel to the Twisting Halls is the same format for the room with the floating key in the middle of the mm-hmm. trap room. Yeah. And I think that the thing about that particular format that I like so much is that you're not just constraining the most frustrating part of the game for me when I watch the Dungeon Masters is when they immediately announce to the table, we're in a skill challenge. All of a sudden I've thrown a lever and we're taking what could potentially be a great role-playing scene into this mechanized nightmare. And so one of the new things about the format, the format shift, at least in the red box and then where I'm trying to do it too and other adventures, is that it's not telling you that this is a roadmap, but rather these are different possible strategies for overcoming the encounter. And so the DM can just fall back and say, all right, well, they can look at the walls, they can play, they can do some arcana stuff or whatever. And there's suggested strategies as well. And I think it's this level of kind of like empowering the DM to do what the DMs do best and what they do already. And I think there's a sense that a lot of DMs are afraid they're running the game the wrong way, and so they cleave really closely to the structured approach rather than saying, well, you know, you want to use nature instead of, or you want to use acrobatics instead of athletics, go for it. You know, because we didn't put the word there, it's not the way it has to be. You can just do it. And if the skill challenge starts looking boring, guess what? They succeeded. Or if they're kludging it, then they failed. You don't have to cleave so closely to the numbers.
And the skill challenge stops being effective when it becomes when it's mechanical instead of organic.
Right,
if
totally.
It's organic to the game, it becomes a pure winner skill challenge.
Right.
That's what a problem that we've seen a lot.
And I think that's just probably an issue of kind of this education, is that I think we need to have more examples. I think we know Mike did a great job in those articles, but I think we could probably do even more. I mean, just saying, you know, even just like video clips where here is a really well-run skill challenge, and this is, and that way that you don't even, because in my games, my players, I mean, I've been running this new campaign for 2 months, and I've run probably 5 skill challenges, and they have no idea, and it worked just fine. So I think that's just one of those things where it's worth. I think, you know, maybe we could do a better job as far as educating DMs to kind of relax about the structure of the rule and realize that what the intent is and go with that instead.
For those who haven't seen Mike's articles, they're in Dungeon Magazine online, which you can go to the Wizards website and download, and it's a whole series that gives specific examples of skill challenges and how to drop them into your game or take those as templates to create your own.
Go ahead.
Just a suggestion, at will. The blog.
Quinn Murphy.
Yeah. He did one episode, I wish he'd do more, of a skill challenge where he's running the skill challenge and he records himself running the skill challenge and then he inserts sort of director commentary.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And at this point they were doing this and so on. So, because if you do give a podcast or something like that, or even a video of skill challenge, and the players aren't aware of it, the DM doesn't really know what's going on behind the screen kind of thing. So if you could give that kind of, you know, even just text or something like that, so that the DM can feel more, people, especially new DMs, you know, who are really feeling kind of intimidated by the format, or get a sense of how it could look.
I know this doesn't help for adventure design, but, you know, the way that I've been running skill challenges for after the first year of 4th edition, I ran them how I thought I was supposed to run them in the book, in a way. And then at the end, I said, okay, I tried that. At the end of the adventure, I look back and I see what the players tried and succeeded at. I give them experience for that. If they failed at something, they failed because they did something ridiculous, and obviously we know it failed. You know, they went up and tried to talk to the guard and they rolled a 1, and
you know, the guard is like, "What? Who are you?" And you know, they get chased all around the town organically. But that may, because I feel like that's the way that we always played AD&D. That's the way we played second edition, way we played third edition when we didn't have skill challenges. I think we were still doing this. We were still doing what skill challenges are now, but like codifying it, I think was a good idea, but it has sort of made a mutant baby.
It's had a negative effect.
Yeah.
An unintended effect.
I like mutant baby. Can we use mutant baby?
A mutant baby.
Yeah, mutant baby.
I like that. Write that down.
I think one of the things we haven't done a lot of in published adventures, in the opportunity, the point where some skill challenges truly shine is when they are happening in the midst of combat. And that's something we should possibly explore more. I did a video cast with the writers and producers of Robot Chicken last year and embedded a skill challenge into a combat encounter. Those are up on YouTube if you ever want to see one. And they have a DM commentary track to accompany them. So look on YouTube for Robot Chicken D&D and you'll find them. Okay. Piece of cake.
Sorry.
And maybe if new for on the website, new DMs, how do I run a skill challenge? Link to that podcast. Because I know in the Encounters series and you're trying to teach these young DMs how to go about and very intimidated, having something that you deserve a resource.
And, by the way, that the dragon example was the one that James Wyatt sent us for Gardenmore as how we should build them. So, in theory, when you look at that, you should see that kind of thing that you're looking for.
And it's also for identifying, and in fact, that's probably, even if you're just doing it for your own games, identifying three or four solutions to the problem helps frame your design when you're going through it, because it's very tempting to say, well, I know what I wanted them to do, and I'll just make four endurance checks, and all right, a stealth check, and an athletics check. All right, I'm done. Yeah, that's a terrible way to build a skill challenge. It's like, well, you are forced to create, you create situations based on what are some possible strategies for overcoming it.
Like in the Dungeon Master's Kit in Essentials, there's a two-part adventure in that box, Reavers of Harkonwald. In the second booklet, There's a situation where you have to sneak into the bad guy's keep. And there's like four or five different ways you can do that, each with their own little skill mechanic to help you along. But it sort of takes that idea and runs with it. You can pretend to be, a supply caravan. You can take the uniforms you took off the guards in the last encounter and try to pass yourselves off as part of the garrison. You can be a wandering troop of entertainers who have just come here to try to, hopefully, to earn a quick, gold coin. All of these things are covered, and then there's one that's like, we don't know what the players will think of, but here are some default rules if they come up with something that's not here. And so I think that is the type of thing that I'd like to see more of.
How have you guys been dealing with the problem of, I've been finding in skill challenges, it almost inevitably results in a party split based on the skill set split. For example, if you're stuck outside a castle, for example, and you're trying to sneak in, you're trying to get in this place surreptitiously, you're gonna have your rogue and whoever else is trained in skill in stealth, like the ranger, they're gonna go in the obvious way. And then the fighter's gonna look at his skill sheet and say, okay, I'm not trained, I've got crap decks, and I'm in full plate.
I have a good suggestion for you, and it's worked really well in my games. And it actually creates, some comedy. And that is to use the idea of the group skill check. Instead of having one character make it and count that a success, have everyone in the group make the stealth check, and if half of the party or more succeed, they all succeed. So the fighter can fail miserably, but he's got the rogue essentially covering for him, and that has solved a lot of the problems, and it's engaged my players more.
Actually, that's exactly what I've been doing as well. I was just wondering, could you guys write that into some more?
We do. We do. In fact, I think
it might be. I think it's in the DM kit, DM's book. It might even be in the
Dungeon Master's Guide too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Group skill checks.
I don't know of any skill challenges I've ever seen where they really, if they allow for a group check at all, it's a forced group check with an assigned skill that comes from the DM. Like in the season 2 Athos, there would be some endurance checks when you're running around the desert. But there were very few of them that allowed the group to initiate any kind of group skill check whatsoever.
Yeah. Greg?
So two things. We definitely are using group checks in some of our upcoming D&D encounter seasons. But one of the things I started doing in my own game and experimenting with is the idea of sort of a hybrid between the group check and the skill challenge, which is I'll present a scenario to the players, and I'll actually be measuring, I'll let them decide what they want to do to overcome that, but I'm actually just measuring that in terms of, at like a group check, where if they all succeed, then, or if half, at least half succeeds, then the group succeeds. So I might say, you enter a giant cavern, there's rubble all over, that you see some shadows flitting about in the corner, and then have the players kind of describe to me what they want to do. I'll ask them for an appropriate check, and then keep track of that. So one character might say, well, I'm going to use my dungeoneering skill to try to identify any underground perils. Or they might just say, I want to identify some underground perils, and I'll either say, well, you can make a perception check or a dungeoneering check. One might say, I want to try and get through the rubble, and I'll say, make an acrobatics check or an athletics check. And again, kind of framing that in a more detailed narrative each time they, whether they succeed or fail. And then using the overall mechanic of, at least half the group succeeded, so they overcame this peril or they faced whatever consequences there are for failure. It keeps the scope of the skill challenge relatively small, but it still lets you kind of break it up into discrete chunks. So I'm not going to measure the whole dungeon in terms of whether they've succeeded or failed at this group check, but I can use that to measure just a single challenge or a single room. What it's worth.
Any other questions or comments or observations about adventures, or any questions you wanted to ask us about freelance writing? Yes, sir.
I had a question. How much time do you guys allow for yourselves to scrutinize your own writing before sending it off to an editor? I mean, four paragraphs there, I find myself combing over those four paragraphs for maybe an hour or two, and I just want to know, when is enough for you to say, I wrote it, send it off to somebody else and see what they say? Like, just personally, how much time do you guys spend doing that?
Let's start over here.
All the time. I spend all the time that I'm given on assignment. On Monster Manual 3, I had 6 monsters to do. I had 2 months to do them, and I took the entire 2 months, and I wrote every day on all of that stuff, and I worked all day, and I worked at night, using my day job to work on D&D.
Did you announce a new player book that I worked on?
The one coming out in November?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
On that Heroes of the Feywild book, it was freaking the biggest project I've had so far. It was supposed to be 50,000 words. I think I turned in 60. And I had the same 2 months, and I worked all the time, and I spent all the time. The thing that I'm working on now is supposed to be 10,000 words. It's 15. And I've worked on it all the time. I've spent all the time that I've had there. So it's like...
How much time do you spend going over work that you've done? Like, are you the type who just sort of writes as you go and doesn't spend a lot of time sort of backtreading over the work, just sort of...
I write it first.
Yeah.
And then I go back over it, and then I go back over it, and then I go back over it, and then I go back over it. Until I feel like I wouldn't be embarrassed if someone read it.
Still,
I don't know if that's a clear answer to
that's
your question.
A counterpoint,
I'm trying
Rob.
To be.
Sorry.
The very first book I wrote, I did something very similar. It was, it was like a 60,000 word book, and I slaved over this book, and I poured my heart and soul into it. And then I started getting assignments on a regular basis. And it was like the realities of publishing come in. It's like, I'm lucky to, it's like you build in. You build in a certain amount of time for review, and then at some point you got to say, I'm done, and I got to get it off my desk because I can't wait any longer. So in a typical 4-week month, I will devote 3 weeks of that month to raw design. And the last week, I will spend two edits to make sure that it's clean. And usually, the first edit is a very intensive edit where I will rewrite almost the whole thing. And then the last edit will be kind of just a polish, looking for the stuff that I missed. But I mean, the thing is that I know that you can waste an extreme. I could waste all sorts of time and be late on every assignment if I couldn't make peace with the fact that I have to rely on other editors to catch stuff. And especially when you're working in big manuscripts, you look at it enough times, it's all one big mess. There's not you're not going to find anything that's bad. I mean, it'll just be there, lost in the page. So you just have to make peace with the fact that it's a team effort. And also, you can't be a prima donna about your work. You've got to be able to say, hey, you know, I screwed up. Please change it. I rely on other people because I know this is a team effort to make this the very best product we can. And if something comes back to me from development that says, well, we think your power stinks, okay. You know, I may disagree with why, but okay. And, that's just a central part of being a game designer is that it is not your thing. You are not... The Book of Vile Darkness is not my book. It is my book, it's Greg's book, it's Mike's book, it's Chris's book, it's everybody's book that has a finger in it. And that's how it's got to be. My name may be on the cover, but it's not mine. So that's just how it goes. Or it may not be on the cover.
Yeah, it's funny that I raised my hand like that. I'm surprised with how little I know about what the final product is going to be. I've done a couple freelance projects, and it'll be instructions. I may be in the dark about what the final project is going to be, but I've got my layer of instructions, and you follow those instructions, and you know that what you're writing isn't going to be exactly what, or not even close to exactly what you have written, but you know it will be there. Somebody else is going to take it. It's going to become theirs and theirs and theirs as it goes development, edit, layout and throughout. So
it's a game I often play. How much of my stuff survived? Yeah. And you know, so you look at a book and you kind of look through it. It's like I think there was a gnome article we wrestled about, Greg. There was a power in there that we had. We're just going to cut it. And it was like, you can't cut this power. There's only seven. So it was one of those things where we went back and forth. But you know, that's just part of it. And that's the deal that you've got. That you sell your soul or you sell your art. You know that this is not just yours. I mean, I hate to beat that to death, but I've been on the other side, and I was a developer for years, and you know the freelancers I worked
you
with
murdered many babies.
I murdered many babies, and the freelancers who were most successful working with that I worked with were the ones who were willing to play ball, and the ones who weren't willing to play ball never worked for me again, and that's just the way it is.
The other thing, if I can chime in, that you've done, Rob, is to offer to take back work if there's been a problem with it, to be willing to say, hey, if you're seeing any systemic issues with this, let me know what I can do better, let me know what I can, if I can spend some time on this to try and ease the amount of work that you guys are going to have to do, and that really helps us on our end.
I come from a very different mindset because I'm sort of equal parts writer and editor. I have a strong editing background, and I worked as an editor for years before I became anything close to what you would call a designer. And so when I write a sentence, I back up, I in a certain span of microseconds, I determine my satisfaction with that sentence in terms of its grammatical structure and content. Then I write the next one, and then I back up and I read that sentence and I string it to the one before it. I'm editing as I go, so that by the time I get to the end of a paragraph, I can look at the paragraph and say, that is the paragraph I want, I'm moving on, and I never look at it again. Wow. Unless I get to the end of a document and I realize I did not end where I expected to end, I need to take another look at this and see if there's something structurally wrong with what I'm doing, or if the place I started wasn't where it needs to start. But really, that's it. I write from the point of view of, it may be the last time on earth I will see it, and I hope it isn't embarrassing.
Yeah, I usually try to I edit not the same pace. Usually I'll wait till I'm at the end, and then I'll go back. I'll try to spend some time away from what I've written, and then I usually read it once and revise, and then I try not to get too caught up in too much revision, because I think that's easy. It's easy at that point to let so your fear of failure kick in, and you start criticizing too much, and the next thing you know, you haven't sent it in. So
I would venture to guess that all three of you are faster writer/designers than me because of the process that I've adopted.
I don't know, because Chris, I do that same thing that you do as well. It just, I think there's no one way. In my experience, there's no one way to do it. It just depends on sometimes the day, the project, and what you need to do. Because sometimes I do exactly what you do. A lot of times I do that and just go over the sentence until the whole paragraph feels right.
You don't write exactly 2,557 words a day?
Sometimes. Sometimes.
Sorry, I'm often accused of being a robot. Just that's sometimes. Very much an in-joke.
Well, I think one thing I'll do, too, is I'm not afraid to throw stuff out. Like, if I'm writing something and it's...
I've seen the stuff you throw out. It's not pretty.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
I've got some really good advice about in the past year from someone who works at Wizards, that to, if you're worried about doing something, just do it the wrong way. Just make yourself do it, but know that you're doing it wrong. And what I'll find happens is I'll start doing it wrong, and then I'll realize, well, this is why this is wrong, and I'll realize, oh, yeah, okay, and now I know the right way, because I've realized what's foolish about this approach, and that points to, well, then here's the smart approach, and I can just take it, throw it out, start all over again. So I think that's one thing, too, where if I write a few paragraphs, and I come back, look at them, and say, you know what, I don't like these. They're just not doing what I want. And I kind of make myself throw all of it out, because then I know I'm serious about starting over again. Because, again, I don't want to get these arguments and stuff, well, I'll just get rid of this and this, and, like, and then I'm not creating, I'm just debating with myself. And it's like, forget it, that's not productive. It's either go move ahead or go back and move in a different direction. Don't just spin around in a circle.
Yeah, I usually, I'll get stuck every once in a while. I think there were sections where I'll be working on something and, you know, I know kind of what I want to say and I'm not able to really get it, and it's just, then you just power through it. You write whatever's out there and you say, this is garbage, this is total garbage, I know it's bad, I will go back and hit it again when I've got a clear idea. And you just type it out, and you move on. That's how I do it. But
and sometimes when you come back, that thing has grown into something lovely. That
yeah, you realize it's like, wow, it actually wasn't that bad after all. Yeah. And you can use it or rework it. But yeah,
so, yeah. Sometimes you just need to tweak it a little bit.
Yeah.
And once you've been away for a few days, it's all the badness is gone.
Yeah.
Can I ask a mechanical process question?
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume, like, I'm thinking about writing a Channel Divinity article. And I honestly don't know where to begin and how the process works. So let's assume I'm interested in this article.
If you're writing it with the intention of getting it published, then the process begins with a pitch. That is, you send to submissions@wizards.com a one paragraph pitch of what you want the article to be and roughly how long you think it'll be. And if you say it's going to be, that what you have in mind is a Channel Divinity article, that saves you a lot of words because we understand what you mean, having done several of them before. So really you just want to get to the nugget of what it is you're trying to do. And if you can encapsulate that idea, and it isn't something that we've got in the pipeline, and it pertains to a class or something that we think that the players would be interested in general, then we will ask for the article. And then the article, and we'll usually staple some sort of date to that, if you could get it to us by bleh. And so you send it to us by bleh, because you're a good freelancer, and we review it in-house to make sure it's not colliding with anything that we're doing, or it's not offering up something that we believe, for whatever reason, is not good for the player experience. And then we will, if we think that it's solid, we will either buy it outright, we'll send it back with a revision request based on whatever internal conversation we've had with the designers. Or we'll say, something's happened in the interim, or there's something fundamentally flawed about this. Ultimately, we've decided not to do it. Usually by the time we've accepted a pitch, there's a fair amount of confidence that if the idea is executed, as we hope it will be, that we'll accept it at that point. But... The two big hurdles are getting the pitch to us in as concise and clear a way as possible, and delivering on the expectations, which is, it's well written, it gives us exactly what we asked for, which is what Mike sort of kicked off this entire discussion talking about. And
so in the pitch, though, for example, let's say with the Channel Divinity article, would you want, how much sort of structural... of a structural outline do you want, or do you simply want a conceptual pitch in the more abstract sense of this?
With something that is of a familiar format, it's okay to be a little bit... You don't have to necessarily spell everything. You don't have to tell us that these are all of the discrete elements that are going to be in there. If you want to hit a highlight, like say, here's an example of what I'm going for, that's perfectly fine. Ultimately, the pitch, when you get to the end of it, if you feel like, oh, maybe this is too much information, i.e. it's maybe a half a page long in email, then it probably is too long. But
do you have a character limit for your
Not specifically, no, because we publish so many different types of articles and adventures and stuff. To hard code that is would not be practical. But if it's two paragraphs, that's probably the limit.
Do you ever go the other way, where you have an idea for X and you put out a request for submission?
Usually when that happens, we often go to a specific individual and we say, we have an idea for X, do you want to you want to tackle this? And they'll say, Steve or Rob or whoever will say, not really my bailiwick, or I'm kind of busy with other stuff right now, but I'd like to be around for the next assignment, please. And we'll say, no problem, we'll pass it off to somebody else, or they'll say, happily.
One of the things that the pitch process, I think, really emphasizes, it sounds like Mike maybe talked about this earlier, is to start up with a really solid concept. I mean, looking at what's already out there and trying to figure out something that if you can just read a short few sentences about it, and that's like, oh yeah, I want to see that article, you know, and sharing it with other people and seeing how they react to it would be another good way to do it before sending it in if you're not sure about it.
Yeah. But
just starting, because we want our articles to have a solid foundation in terms of the story. Beginning there is the best place, and then don't get too bogged down thinking about the mechanics too early on.
Yeah,
it's very even for all my freelance experience, when I sent pitch documents in, it was always far more important to just have to summarize your entire thing in one super awesome sentence that says, this is going to blow you away with this, with my opening sentence, and then you can get into little details later on. But it's just really, it doesn't matter who you're sending it to. The pitch document is your first step in anything, and that's you've got to sell it without having to worry about mechanics or over details. Just say, I'm going to write an article about Paylor, and it's going to turn you into a ball of light that sings songs. That's your pitch.
Awesome. Yeah. Run with that.
You do. I'll get right here. All right.
That's great. Ball of light.
Let's sing songs.
Yeah. And part of that importance about keeping it concise, but really sort of capturing the essence of what it is you want the article to be about, is important just from a practical point of view, because we see hundreds of these things every week. And the editor's really got to just digest it very quickly. If it seems like you seem to be fumbling to get to the point, then the article is going to be fumbling to get to the point.
Yeah.
Also helped if there's no typos in the pitch.
Yes. Professionalism is definitely a plus, yes.
I guess probably a couple months back it was mentioned that the reason you guys weren't printing many epic adventures were just that there weren't many being submitted that were what you were looking for. You'd already mentioned one complaint. A lot of them are just heroic tier adventures conducted at a high level. What are some of the other major flaws that you see in the submissions you are getting for epic tier adventures?
That's a key one. Another one is that, I'm trying to think of specific examples here. Sometimes they try to outwit themselves. They're too complicated. It's like, if with my experience, if I look at a pitch and I think, oh, they're not going to be able to pull this off in 6,000 words or 10,000 words, then it gets sort of tossed back. If it's an interesting idea, it might get tossed back with a suggestion to give us a more simplified version. Like, you've got seven things going on here. I know it's epic and it's supposed to feel really big, but giving the character seven different tasks to do is probably overboard. Try aiming for one or two with maybe some character hooks or something in, and you'll have much better luck. We get that a lot. Often it's not specific to epic tier, but to adventures in general, that we get a lot of very similar plot lines that come through. And so an idea might get rejected not necessarily because it's bad, but because we have something already in the hopper that sort of covers that, even if it's not an epic level adventure per se. I think part of it too is just motivations, finding interesting things for the villains to do at that level that will be compelling to the characters. And fleshing that out. Often we see epic proposals where it's not really clear what the bad guy is doing and why. He wants to blow up the world? Why?
Yeah. I have a complaint about epic level monsters.
Yeah.
They are not epic. They do more damage. They have a few more powers. but the same, but they have the same types of powers that lower level monsters do. It's the same fireball, it just does more damage. It very often doesn't even have a bigger blast radius. You know, a giant worm that's supposed to be threatening an entire kingdom has the same blast radius that, you know, an adult. Excuse me?
That's a fair point. We can take more chances with our design. It's very easy for a designer, any designer, no matter how skilled or lauded, to fall back on what's been done before. And I think one of the hallmarks of the best designers in the business is that they don't care about what's been done before. They go out there and they try to give us something new. And that can be a challenge, but like you say, after you expect something at that level, and so far we have underwhelmed.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm not going to make up excuses for that.
Something that's in the back of my mind since we started the conversation is, with Essentials out, what should a freelancer be writing towards? Should we, based on the new Essentials books, and leave the others behind, or go to the older hardbacks and do that?
I would assume that the Essentials is sort of the baseline, but anything is in play.
Everything's in play.
Yeah, so if the only thing to watch out for, like, losing a creature is just generally the Essentials version, say, of the Green Dragon, would be kind of the standard one we'd use. So if you're going to use a Green Dragon, you use the MM1 or the Monster Vault 1, I'd run the side using the Monster Vault version. But I'd assume that you could have a PH1 fighter, or as far as assuming with character tab and things like that.
And the reason why we make that point is because we spiked the monsters' damage because we realized monsters weren't doing enough damage. So the more current monsters are actually more accurate and fun.
Yeah.
And that's why we'd want to focus on using monsters from the later books.
Okay. Monsters from the later books, but if you make NPCs, you can do that from anything within 40.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Settings and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So. And the length of one is 6,000 to 10,000, did I infer today?
Is that for articles?
Oh, no, I was thinking of the adventure itself.
Oh, it can vary. Our longest adventure, well, anything I say is going to be a lie. Our longest adventures, we aim nowadays between 10 and 15,000 words. That's on the long side. We generally prefer shorter experiences. 10,000 is, if you're treading beyond 10,000, then, or if you imagine an adventure that's going to be 10,000 or more words long, we'll need to think about that.
And if someone's sending you a manuscript, how much of the formatting type information do you want them to do? Could they just say, this monster, Monster Mania page, what? Or do they have to type all that in? If it's pulled straight from.
Yeah.
It should be, I think we should have, the writer's guidelines should be up on the website.
They are up on the, I think we specify in the guidelines, I don't remember, it's been so long since I looked at them.
So Chris, I think what we've been doing on the magazine lately is just having designers suggest monsters with a page reference.
Yeah, if it's a straight pickup from a book,
yeah.
I think we just tell us where you got it, and then we'll just drop it in.
I'll say that's when I add the words.
Right, yeah. Because the reason we do that is because, and you can say, what I'm submitting to you is 9,000 words minus stat blocks and whatever. We don't really count the stat blocks anyway. The reason we suggest that is so that human error does not get in the way, and you in retyping a stat block, you introduce something that isn't there, and suddenly we have two different versions of the same stat block that are different. That causes us problems on our end.
So if you want the manuscript, you're really wanting the story.
Yeah. But if you have a unique NPC or a unique monster that requires its own stat block, it would need to be there because that constitutes new design. It's not something we can just plug in easily.
Mine's not actually 15,000 words. I lied about that.
For submissions, do you guys prefer original content as far as monsters, or do you prefer for somebody to just take something that's already been created, perhaps from Monster Manual 3 and beyond?
We prefer to be surprised. So seeing things we haven't seen before is always a thrill. Now, you can surprise us in other ways. For instance, you can surprise us with a take on orcs we've never seen before. In which case, this cool new band of orcs that that somebody can drop into their campaign and use, and they've got this shtick that is so freaking awesome that we would be fools not to present these orcs. I would be all over that.
If an adventure has entirely new monsters, though, it's a big load of work on the development side, and so trying to balance those two factors is
important. I could see somebody pitching an idea for a compelling adventure that had a very compelling, unique monster that we'd never seen before, that's sort of intrinsic to that adventure. Like maybe you've got an adventure that's on the plane of mirrors and you need some sort of mirror monster that doesn't really exist in the game or hasn't been updated in two editions. I could see that being an exception to the rule. But by and large, I wouldn't just invent monsters for monsters' sake. They have to be justified.
You know, I actually resent having to invent monsters for my storylines.
I don't blame you.
I do.
Yeah. Now, granted, monster design for me is like the most—that is one of the most fun activities of the game.
It's easy. I love the fact that the monster builder has made that easy. But I really, really want to concentrate on story.
Yep.
And then I go to the monster builder to find the monster that. Okay, crunch time.
Yeah.
And that's my, like I said, that's why I hate, you know, all the epic level monsters. It's the same blast. It's the same fireball. I want something that feels iconic.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's crunch time.
I love monster design.
Me too.
Fourth edition monster design. I hate third edition monster design. I'm just going to say that on the microphone.
I didn't realize how hard it was until I took that design test that I took applying for that job in 2007, because I think the way that everybody ran third edition monsters is, you know, you just kind of fudge what's out there a little bit high or low when you play. But when I actually had to do it, I was like, well, wait a minute. Everything here keys onto some other type, onto some, if you have a template, it goes onto this certain type. And the math took me hours and hours and hours and hours to, you know, create something that would die in 5 minutes, yeah. Seconds.
The last 3.5 book I worked on was Elder Evils, and that book about killed me.
Yeah.
Atropos, the world born dead. Its stat block was insane.
All right. Well, we are out of time, folks. So I want to thank you for coming, and I hope you got something out of this. And thanks for participating.
No, you do.